Tom Ivester, an alcoholic. I feel like I must be dead or something. I feel like I've just been eulogized. Not real well, but I thought I was still sucking air anyway. I'm a member of the Primary Purpose Group of AA in Southern Pines, North Carolina. And I am delighted to be here. I want to congratulate you on an outstanding conference. And just saying, I think it took us about 4 years to get to this level. Yeah, we do everything slow down there. This is just highly impressive. The great work and everything just worked out awfully well. I'm just hoping that active committee can find some way to energize Julia a little bit, get her to have a little more spark. If she gets it more, we'll have to rescue her from the moon or somewhere. She's gonna leave this earth. I've heard of rocketed to a fourth dimension, but come on now. This is afterburners all lit up. So it really is neat to be here. And I want to share with you, I kind of have an aversion to circuit speakers, too. That's why I'm not one. I'm a drunk trying to be a service. That's what I do. What I do here, I hope, would not be any different than what I'd do in a just a regular old rock'em sock'em meeting down in North Carolina. If it is, then I got to watch what I'm doing. I might have gotten into performing instead of sharing. And so I like well very much to stick to sharing what this program's about. I'm a truly fortunate man. I'll explain to you why as we go along, but I really do believe that I'm probably the most fortunate man that I know. I've been richly, richly blessed. And spend a little bit more time on that sometime later on. I'm just an average slice of life. I'm going to try to concentrate a good deal tonight on stuff that we're here concerned about. And that's about this whole world of corrections and AA and corrections and the things that are vitally important in that from my perspective. I'm no expert on it. I swear to God, I think I knew a lot more 47 years ago than I do now. I got a lot more questions now than I had 47 years ago. I've learned just enough to know how little I know. But I have, for the last, it'll be 48 years in November, that I seriously doubt that there's been a single day of my life that I haven't either been engaged in something about corrections or thinking about something. I doubt if it's been a single day that this hasn't been a prominent kind of thing. I don't mean I dwell on it, I'm phobic about it, but it's just a very important thing to me, and I think I've focused on it a great deal and doubt that I've ever missed a full day. And so it is something that's a way of life, and that's what I want to share is a lot of that kind of stuff with you. I'm just an average cat. Alcoholism happens to some of us, sometimes quickly and sometimes slowly. But it always happens if we'll hang in there. And we have the right makeup for it to click. It looks to me like it is very much that way. Some folks drink with relative impunity, as the book says, for a number of years, and then they just kind of lose it and fall off the deep end, real alcoholic. There are others, of whom I think I was an early prototype, that are basket cases from day one. And I was that one. There's more and more of those today. And the good old-fashioned bourbon-swigging alcoholic is almost a relic of the past. And now we got so darn many things that'll crank you to the moon that it's just unbelievable. And I mean, folks get into trouble. Yeah, I work with a lot of young people, and what I find is that they're very old people in young bodies. Well, I tell you, it is something else. So I think I was one of the early test models of that. And I was a guy that when I started boozing, seriously, I was in my teens, and I started seriously boozing, And I just fell in love with that stuff. Yeah, I wasn't born alcoholic. I wasn't an instant alcoholic. I wasn't an alcoholic at all. I was just the sort of guy that was, like you hear said all the time, I just didn't feel real comfortable with this thing called life. I was a miserable, twerpy kid. And man, when I found booze, I found a magical solution. I just flat loved that stuff. And I took it up as a way of life. Nobody had to train me to do it. It was just natural. Man, I took to that thing real, real quick and did my darndest to stay there. Man, I just went wild with it. Loved that way of life. Loved the trashy behavior. I loved those unseemly people that engaged in it. And loved all that junky stuff that was going on with waking up in strange places with strange folk. And just the regular run-of-the-mill stuff. So I was a real, real, just kind of a guy that just found something great in booze. And I'll tell you something now. I'm not a moralist. I'm not here a temperance worker. If I had been able to do that, as ugly as it looked, I'd be doing it right now. But something unfortunate happened to me. I developed alcoholism. Yeah. If I hadn't, I probably would still be out there crashing and banging. But something happened. I don't understand what it was, but something happened to me. Best I can tell, when I was about 18 years old, we describe it as crossing a line from that kind of wild, crazy, recreational party, whoopee drinking. I crossed that line and moved into uncontrolled drinking or alcoholism. Now, I didn't notice it when it happened. I think I was quite drunk at the time. And I had no earthly idea that anything radically different had happened. Yeah, I drank as much as I could before I was alcoholic. That's all I could hold. And when you get so drunk you can't lay on the floor, that's about as good as it gets. And I don't care whether you're alcoholic or not. Yeah, and I did that long before I was alcoholic. But something happened, yeah, and I didn't realize it till I got sober and looked back. And then when that life started to show up through the fog, I could see that somewhere in that 18th year, and I could start to recall that strange behavior of the alcoholic that started to emerge. That if I took a drink, I simply could not predict what I would do. Couldn't predict how much I'd drink, how long I'd drink, what I'd do, nothing. If I took a drink, it was an adventure. And so I just sort of went wild. And, well, I didn't go wild. I was wild, and I got wilder with that. And I was the kind of guy that never stopped drinking because it was a good idea. Had a lot of people tell me I ought to because it was a good idea. But I've never stopped drinking just on good judgment. I marvel at people who say, I've had enough. I have never said that in my life. I mean, never. That if I took a drink, I stopped when I hit the wall or got in jail or a psych ward or a hospital or God knows what all. You know, but that was the way it was. I was just not somebody who had any decorum or control or manageability in my life. Man, if I took a drink, look out. Look out. She was on. And that happened in my 18th year. And from the time that happened, my life just absolutely accelerated downhill. I made a lot of progress, but it was all backward. I did everything backward. I was the kind of guy, if I was sober, I made a good impression on people. I always looked pretty decent. Well, I mean, I'd clean up real quick, and I'd go looking for a job. People would hire me for a better job than I'm looking for. And then I'd work my way down and out. And so that was just my pattern, that it was that just steady progression. And what I didn't notice while that was going on was that I was just incrementally working my way down. Because every time I would crash and burn somewhere, suck it up and start over, what I didn't notice was that every time I'd start over, I'd start a notch lower and a notch lower. Our book, I won't dwell on it tonight, but our book really describes the condition of my mind during that period. Sometimes we use the term denial to talk about what's going on with alcoholism. You won't find that in the book because it isn't in there. And obviously Bill Wilson, the word merchant he was, knew the word. I just don't think he elected to use it because it's not adequate to describe the condition. You know, denial is basically an intellectual joust or something. It's where you're looking at the evidence that's closing in and saying, no, that ain't right. You know, what was happening to me during that period, the book describes it as a life of illusion and delusion, an inability to differentiate the truth from the false. And I swear to you, to the best of my knowledge, I never saw my behavior till I was sober and looked back. Never recognized that. But my life just became that seemingly endless series of just banging up against the wall and going steadily downhill. And my serious drinking lasted a grand total of 8 years. And in that 8 years, I did about as much damage as a fellow could do. I started out fairly decently, set out in the military to become an officer, was thrown out with an undesirable discharge when I was 20 years of age. And then just kind of matriculated is a little fancy word. I just wondered is what I did. And when I got thrown out of the military, I just sort of migrated wherever drunks congregated. And I either went with a pack or took a pack. I don't know why, but we settled in a place, God forgive me, where are we?
Florence,
Illinois. Well, I may be far enough away to be safe. I wound up in Flint, Michigan. Wonderful place. If you haven't been there, you may want to go. It's a little like La Jolla out in California. Or Maui or something. If you drink enough wine, it's like that. Flint's bad news, I tell you that. I don't think it's improved with age. It ain't like wine. It's got worse. Man, the only time I ever get homesick for Flint is when I go there. And, man, I get sick before I get inside the city limits. So anyway, the only good thing I know about Flint, it gave me a fleeting feel of accomplishment. I lived there and messed that town up best I could. It didn't need much help, but I contributed. And one year, Flint was voted the worst city in the United States in which to live. And I kind of took a little pride in that. You know, at least I put them on the chart. You know, I did my little piece. But I mean, I just migrated up there. You know, and settled in, if you could call it that. Worked at General Motors till my reputation got in front of me. And in a city like that, of 500,000 people, I couldn't get a job. I got blackballed at General Motors, and I just sort of goofed around and screwed up everything I touched. I won't go into all the stuff I did. Some of it was even legal, but just barely. So anyway, we'll deal with that some other night. It's not a deep, dark secret. It just takes too long. And when I get into that, I go forever. I wound up living a kind of life that I didn't even know existed. Yeah, I mean, I grew up in Mayberry down there in North Carolina. And we didn't have street crime on every corner. I mean, you know, it cut you down there, stuff like that. But, I mean, they were nice about it. They just cut you. They wouldn't take your money. But Flint was, it's just a different place. And it's amazing how you can fit in. You know, that delusion set in. And as I incrementally worked my way to the streets in Flint, Michigan, it became remarkably normal. It looked normal. I'd look out through the haze and see people going to work, taking kids to school, and they looked bizarre to me. My life was the only one that seemed normal. And so I just absolutely went down and wound up basically just living off folk. I mean, anybody that would listen to me long enough, I'd get into them for something. I just used and abused and took advantage of folks. The food chain in that place was the survival of the fittest. You know, in that environment, you either roll somebody or they roll you, depending on whoever was holding. And I wasn't reared to do that kind of thing. But when you live in a jungle, you live by the laws of the jungle, or you don't live. That's just as simple as that. And I never believed I'd ever wind up. Wind up selling my blood $5 a throw. Yeah, that's what the guys did. I lined up and did it with them. I'd have let them suck me dry if they had to stop me. I mean, I was just gone. And I'm talking about a young fellow in his early 20s. Yeah. And so that was the place I went. I was just one of those cases that just deteriorated and overnight. Guys like me don't make old drunks. There's no way. They ain't going to survive that. And, you know, it'd be real nice if I could tell you that one fine day I had enough and heard there was hope for help for people like me, but that just didn't happen. And I wound up doing, several of you, and you're well aware, so I wound up doing the kind of thing that I think every alcoholic lives in dread of doing, fear of doing. And thank God most don't. The worst fears of most alcoholics never happen. But sometimes they do. Sometimes those bad dreams become real nightmares, and I was one of those that I came to one morning in the Genesee County Jail. No novelty. That was a fairly routine procedure for me. And I assumed when I came to that I was in there for the same as always, just either drunk, hustling, scuffling on the street, whatever. And wake a little while, jailer came by, knew him well. And I said, hey, when can I get out? And he'd normally say 10 o'clock. But that day he said, I hope never, and walked off. Had not a clue what he was talking about. Not a clue. But I knew he was serious. He was not kidding a bit. And then later on, I went back into the tank, and some of the other guys in there apparently had read the paper or something. The night before, I'd gotten hold of somebody's car and driving blind, drunk, blacked out down the main street of that city, ran down, killed two people. And that kind of, you know, there's no way to even imagine the impact of that. There's no way to imagine trying to accommodate that. And my response, I guess, was predictable to somebody who understands the human mind, that your mind protects itself and won't accept what it can't handle. And that was my immediate response. I just could not. I could believe it, but I just couldn't handle it, and then gradually accepted the truth. The only time I'd ever been in jail to try to get out. And I didn't care. I mean, I was done. I had absolutely no aspirations, no hopes, no schemes. I was done. I mean, absolutely done. I didn't want. I was ashamed to get. I couldn't stand to fail. I was ashamed to be breathing, and somebody for some reason, there was a policeman there, have no idea who he was, but I gathered it, so it was a policeman there. Learned I had family in North Carolina. Called him up and said, "You got a guy up here in a lot of trouble," and as mothers do, her and my sister loaded up and came to get me out of what has so far been the last jail they've ever had to get me out of. It wasn't the first one, but it was the last one. It certainly was for my mother when she died 29 years after I got into AA with a heart full of gratitude for a son that had, a program that had given her a son for that many years. And if I never got any other thing for whatever I do in AA, that'd be more than adequate payment. Sister's still living, and so if I don't stay in this program, she may have a chance to come back and get me. But that was, I didn't know how to tell them. I didn't want to get out, and they got an attorney. I was charged with manslaughter. They negotiated my release on bond. And when I got out, I knew I wouldn't drink. I mean, God knows, there nobody could possibly drink with that much guilt. If you understand alcoholism, you know that was the least likely time that I wouldn't drink. But I didn't understand any of that stuff. I just know I got out on the 17th of July, and on the 18th of July I was as drunk as a human's ever been. Did my best to stay that way for the next several months, and then 19th of November of 56 was the day I hope and pray was my last drink. Has been so far. I didn't know it was going to be. I knew it was going to be the last one for a long time. But I was to be tried that day, and there was no trial to it. There was no defense. The hell of blackouts is you can't even testify at your own trial. And I couldn't testify at my own trial. I'm not even a witness to my own behavior. And so I was obviously, I was very definitely found guilty and sentenced to a max at the state prison of Southern Michigan, the maximum custody penitentiary at Jackson. I remember that day as clearly as if it were today. When that judge passed that sentence, I guess it's just human nature. I had an instinctive reaction of fear, and at the same time, the most real sense of relief I'd ever known, because I knew it was over. Not optimism or hope or new day. I knew it was done. And when I walked out that door, it was a one-way trip. The next day, I walked into to Jackson Prison. That's what they call that place. And resigned to my fate, knew that it was a one-way trip, that I would never come out of there alive. And I believe to this day, had it not been for the miraculous intervention of this program, that forecast would have been true. I don't think I would have ever survived in there if I'd have tried to do it on street skills and all that kind of stuff. That was a bad joint. At that time, and probably still is, it was the largest walled institution in the entire world. And the day I walked in, there were 6,000 tragic stories locked up in that place. And I was just one more face in the crowd. And so I knew when I went into that sea of hopelessness that it was absolutely done. And I was a mighty sick young fellow. I didn't know how sick I was until I started to clear up and start to realize and take a look at what my life had been. And it was a bad news journey, I'll tell you that. When I look back on my life, I don't know what yours looked like to me, to you, but when I look back on the first 24 years of my life, and this is not melodrama, this is an absolute fact, I could not pull forward any redeeming act that I had ever done. I mean, not one. I didn't even get a merit badge in the Boy Scouts. I couldn't pull up one thing and say, well, geez, at least I did that. I didn't know one person that wouldn't have been better off if they had never known me. Especially my family, you know, they were trapped. Most people could get away from me. They couldn't go anywhere. I mean, they just were there with me. And so that's what I was looking at. And then to look at having culminated that life with committing a crime so horrible that there's no suitable punishment for it. There is no suitable punishment for a guy that takes two lives. What would you do? And so that's what I was carrying with me when I walked in, living under an absolute mountain of guilt. And it's amazing to me about what turns around a life, eh? That is, it's not huge things as a rule. It can be just little things. And what happened to me, they put me in there, sat in a cell, I didn't engage in conversation with anybody. And I'll tell you this, we've talked a little about CPC and PI today, and I'm a great, I'm committed. I've got a fundamental commitment in corrections, but I have a strong commitment to every other area of service in our fellowship, and particularly CPC and PI. It's for obvious reason when you hear what I'm going to tell you that. But you think about it, when you think back to where your sobriety started, what was it that put the wheels in motion and culminated with your being a member of Alcoholics Anonymous? And I'll guarantee you, whatever that was, you've got a loyalty to it second to none. Well, that's where life comes from. And what happened with me, and if it had not been for what happened, if my coming to Alcoholics Anonymous had depended one iota on any initiative on my part, I would have never come. Now, I know that without any question. I was so full of guilt and shame and remorse, I couldn't have asked anybody for help. There's no way. Now, I just could not have reached out. And what happened? I got called out one day for an interview by a fellow, that was a social work type of fellow, and he did a routine kind of a how-do-you-do interview with me, and I'd been through that stuff before. I've been diagnosed many times, always with something that was some synonym of drunk. You know, either you're a bad drunk, you're a problem drinker, you're an alcoholic. I'd heard that stuff. And every time somebody would declare that, they would go on with some idiotic sounding stuff like, why don't you quit drinking? Well, I never could think of a good reason to quit drinking. Yeah, God, drunk was bad enough. And so I never had thought of a good reason. I tell you this, I don't know if I was the dumbest guy on the block or what, but I had never connected the first drink with where I wound up. I mean, it seems simple. But I never thought that. I always thought I wound up in those idiotic situations because I was a worthless guy. I never connected if I took a drink, something happened to me. I never considered such a thing. And so this guy did his deal. He made the same diagnosis. He said, man, you've had a lot of trouble with booze. I said, yeah, it was obvious. Anybody knew that. I mean, but I was just kind of a party guy. And he said something I'd never heard. He said, we have an AA group here, and I think you ought to go. Now, it was just it wasn't some marching in type of stuff. You know, it was just a flat statement. We have a deal, you ought to go. They help folks like you. I don't think he tried to explain it, and I'm glad of it, because I don't think he knew anything about it. He knew as much as he needed to know. if you got a guy with a case like that and it's all about booze, tell him he ought to go to AA. That's exactly what he did. If he'd have tried to give me some kind of Rogerian group therapy or something, he'd have probably screwed me up worse. And but he just sort of got to the point. Man, go over there, the folks fix it. And I went out of the office, walked out of his office. A little later, got a little piece of paper. It wasn't even a letter, just a little thing, looked like an old telegram. He said, you can go to your first meeting. You had to be on a list. He said, you can go to your first meeting February 2nd of 57. I didn't want to go to AA. And I didn't particularly not want to go. I wanted to sit in my cell and stare at my navel. That's what I wanted to do. And do whatever I could do to keep from thinking. And so I walked in that day, and it was not a bounce in my step. I just was sort of just dragging in there. I just had no fight left, you know, and so I just wandered in and sat down in my first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous and listened to what we do. My greatest fear was that it was going to be kind of churchy, and my fears were realized pretty quickly. First thing they did was pray, same thing we did here tonight. And I thought, yeah, boy, won't be long till the snakes are coming out. And I'd left that stuff before I started school and swore I wouldn't go back. And I thought they got me. Then they started reading all that stuff. You know, we read more stuff. God knows if I'd read the newspaper. We read a lot of stuff. And that looked churchy to me. And then they introduced the speaker, and he did not look churchy. I tell you that. This guy, we got some delegates here. The guy that spoke at my first meeting was the delegate for the state of Michigan to the General Service Conference. And when I got through listening to him, I thought he was the biggest yo-yo I had ever seen in my life. He told his story. He told the truth. I mean, nobody gonna make that up. My God, I could have made up a better story than that in DTs. And I mean, that was bad stuff. And I thought, God knows, why is he doing that? I mean, why would you get up in front of 300 hairy-legged convicts and tell some god-awful story like that? Yeah, he didn't look too bad if you didn't get too close, you know, but he had on that obligatory blue preaching suit, and he was going at it. If you got close, he didn't stand close examination very well. He was an ex-everything. That guy had done everything in Norway. He'd been a professional boxer at one time. And apparently a very poor one. He was game. He took a lot of shots, I could tell that. And I liked the old boy, but he was just nutty. And I thought, Jesus, man, somebody turned him loose somewhere. And I left totally confused. I mean, I did not identify with one syllable of any word he uttered. I mean, God knows he was as polar opposite of me as a man could possibly be in my mind. And miracle of miracles, I was back the next week. You know, we talk about this being a program of attraction. The program of attraction is not a 30-second blip on the television or a billboard or a dog and pony show. The program of attraction is me and you. And when we get around somebody who's taking a look at this program, they're either attracted or repelled by what they see in us. And the amazing thing is that I was back that next week. Now, just like I said, that I was totally different than that man. But I think the one thing that brought me back was that magical quality of enthusiasm that was his life. He was the most enthusiastic person I think I've ever seen in my life. When he spoke, it was just a tumble of just trying to race and keep up with it. He was just a phenomenal man. And I didn't think that day. But I just found myself back. You know, I found myself, now, I don't mean an irresistible urge or something, but I just found myself going back to something that seemed bizarre to me. And it was that spirit. It was the attraction of somebody. I guess his life demonstrated that there was life after recovery. And so it was enough to bring me back. I am deeply thankful that this program has extremely low standards. Low standards. Thank God we don't have some kind of a screening process or a committee that decides on pedigree or whatever. that the only requirement, as far as I'm concerned, to getting going in this program is about that much willingness. That much willingness. Just enough to crack the door. And that's what happened. You know, that sort of energy that I felt from this guy, even though I wasn't consciously aware of it, it cracked the door enough that I must have just thought to myself, I better go back and see what that's about. And I stayed there 3.5 years and never missed a single meeting, whether it was once a day or once a week or whatever. I never missed a single one. But you can hurry up and believe I was not a real quick convert. I was not somebody that caught the fever. I don't think I've ever felt more out of place anywhere than I felt in Alcoholics Anonymous. I really didn't believe I was an alcoholic. Yeah, I knew I'd drunk a lot. Yeah, I knew that had been my way of life. I knew that. But I didn't believe I was alcoholic. When I heard people talk about alcoholism as an illness, it kind of embarrassed me. I thought, what on earth is an illness about getting drunk? Yeah, my God, that didn't make sense to me. And so I sat there and it was totally out of place. I was the youngest guy in there by several years. They normally didn't keep people my age in the maximum custody joint, but I never got out of it. And it wasn't because I was Charles Manson or something. But I was I guess my history pretty well proved if this cat takes a drink, you're going to look for him. And he's going to be gone somewhere bizarre. And so they just kept me there. Maybe they liked me. I don't know. They sure didn't give me any daylight. I know that. And so I kept going back. And slowly, I started to just, with that little crack of an opening, started to get a little bit quizzical about this thing. It's funny, but when I listened to speakers, what it sounded to me like they said, now I know it's not what they said, but what it sounded to me like they said was that they were alcoholic because when they drank, they got in trouble. Well, my God, if that's what alcoholism, I've had that all my life, man. I have been in trouble all my life and never sober. I've never been in jail sober. Been there more times than I know, but never sober. Never did wake up in the hospital with something broken I didn't even know was injured. Sober. Never woke up sleeping on the railroad tracks. Sober. Did drunk. Middle of a U.S. highway. Did drunk. Married to somebody I didn't know. I mean a stranger. Yeah. That is wicked liquor when you start doing that stuff. Well, if trouble is the name of the game, well, surely I had that. And so I just kind of ignored, intellectually said, I've done stuff like that. Man, I just have this too. And I said I was alcoholic. Didn't really believe it. Deep down, I didn't really believe it. But thank God for that little requirement, because that was enough to keep me at the table. And so I kept going. I was fortunate in that the recovery group at Jackson Prison was as fine an AA group as I have ever intended, including the one I belong to today. It was an excellent group of Alcoholics Anonymous. It wasn't a gaggle of inmates just gathering to listen to some strange man from outside. It was a group of alcoholics in action. That's who we are. And these were alcoholics in action. And I will forever be grateful for the quality of the group that I went in, because that group really did an excellent job of the fifth tradition of that each group has one primary purpose, to carry its message to the alcoholic still suffers. I was given an introduction, a no-nonsense, but not a tyrannical kind of a thing, but I was given a good sound and solid introduction to this program by a bunch of guys in the joint, just like me. Only difference, they were in front of me a bit, and they were sharing what they had. Now, I became one of those guys later on who worked with the new guys coming in. And it was marvelous. It's the first place I ever heard the term design for living. And I've never forgotten it. That had great meaning to me. The guys pointed out that in this thing, your motives didn't even matter. If you take the actions that are laid out in the steps, you are absolutely guaranteed you're going to be a different cat by the time you get through. I didn't know that at the time, but by golly, it's true. And so I was given a good, sound, and solid introduction. I was introduced to what action's about. Back then, I didn't even know that there was an option to either serve or not serve. Nobody ever bothered to tell me. They just said, come on. I'd go with them wherever we were going. We had a wonderful time. Started new groups. It's kind of interesting conquest in a Max Augustine Penitentiary. We started one in the mental institution in there. A very, very interesting meeting. In fact, sometimes there'd be 8 or 10 going on at the same time, you know, about to I don't know if any of them ever got lucid and straightened up or not, but I did. And it was an effort. You know? So it was just a strong, active group of people. And man, I tell you, I learned something important about the critical importance of belonging. Just my history, I was more isolated than average. But I'll guarantee you there are people sitting in this room tonight who do not feel the warmth of the fellowship. For people who are extremely isolated, the warmth of the fellowship is not inviting and welcoming. It's frightening. It's frightening. And isolated people don't respond well to that. They respond by tensing up or backing away. And this thing of getting involved so that I was physically occupied with doing the things that we did as a group fostered that sense of belonging. First time I ever really felt that in my life. Got into the steps, and I won't bog down in them tonight as much as I'd love to. I'll just say that that certainly is the heart of the program. That is the program. And if it weren't for that, if it weren't for those steps, I'll just say that one little transition in there that I'll talk about, and I'll skip over to Rhett. You know, I was getting a sort of a fleeting hold on the first part of the steps. You know, I'd gotten at least an intellectual grasp of what I conceived to be a power. I did grudgingly admitted I was powerless. Didn't go deep, but it was enough. And then I had a true huge turning point, one of many, but it was a huge turning point when a guy came and spent the entire meeting on the fourth step. And when he got through with it, I went back to my cell. I was always a reader. I'd read the book, and I understood the words. I understood the activities that were described. But having the experience is a totally different thing. And this guy went into great detail. I went back to my cell, and I said, okay, I'm going to do that. Pulled out the old trusty legal pad, sat down to write. I meant to write a little story about how cruel life was and what a victim of circumstances I was and how such a nice guy as me ever got in such a mess. That's really what I meant to do. But the founders were wise when they said, write the inventory. That made sense as long as I kept it up here. I could rationalize anything. But I sat down. I meant to write that little story, sad story. Meant to write that thing, and probably would have shown it to anybody. I probably would have published it if anybody would write it. And I wrote two lines. It's absolutely true. Wrote two lines, and then all at once, nothing shocking, but all at once, I think that life of illusion and delusion came into focus. And all at once, I just stopped. And in one motion, with no intent, no preparation, no form, no nothing, I opened up and just poured out my heart. That's all. My hand raced trying to keep up with just the torrent of the things that were coming out. And when I got through, I had 3 pages on that legal pad of just this hopeless scribble. Nobody could have read it. Nobody's supposed to. I tell you this. That was the most important work, this old boy's ever done in his entire life, bar none. More important than the day I married, my son was born, my daughter, my career started, my career ended. More important, because everything in my life suspended from what happened that day, because I was a different man when I finished that. When I got through with that, I knew I was alcoholic, period. Period. That not the young guy, not the whiz kid, I knew I was alcoholic. It's just like our book says, that we learned that we had to fully concede to our innermost selves that we were alcoholic. First step in recovery. That is not like admission. You know, I told you I was alcoholic in the beginning. That doesn't touch what we're talking about. This talks about down at the cellular level, I'm a guy who is beat. I'm not a guy who is wised up. I'm a guy who is beat. I can't drink. It's not that I won't. I can't. It's a done deal for me. And I'll tell you this, there's never been anything more important, because from that day to this, my fellow alcoholics and good friends, That war has been over. It is done. I have not doubted for one microsecond that I'm an alcoholic. That's the foundation from which the new life came. That's called surrender. And I really believe that sobriety doesn't happen in a good, solid kind of way without the experience of surrender. And that was phenomenally important to me. I've never been the same man. I will never know what craving is like ever again in my life unless I violate one rule, and that's to take a drink of anything with alcohol in it, and then all bets are off. But that thing is done, and it'll never bother me again unless I activate it with a drink. What I'm left with is a mind that is incredible. Good God. It is bizarre. You know, I believe every person who comes into AA rides a tiger of some sort. They don't all look alike, but we all own one. And the function of, a lot of it lived right up there. A lot of the function of this program is to make that dude lay down, at least, you know, and go to sleep if he can, you know. But you know, to live at peace with this thing and to start a new life. So that was a huge turning point. And the only other thing I mentioned, I called that a transition. Those next steps are to me, as critically as important as any, you know, the fifth. But then the sixth and seventh, where we come to a point of decision. It basically says, you want to get well or don't you? You want a new life or don't you? You want to try to work both sides of the street, or are you ready to walk straight? Decision time. Decision time. And when I finally got to that point, and then truly, truly became ready to have God remove these defects of character, my life still has not been the same. I think that's the point where I became an alcoholic in recovery, not in self-examination, not in exploration of my character, but an alcoholic in action toward a new way of life. And that decision is the fulcrum of AA, as far as I'm concerned, in terms of that program of recovery. And in the rest of the steps, I won't visit them, but just say that, not because they're not important, they're about restoration. They're about what puts the new life together. They're about clearing out that wreckage of the past so that I can breathe free at last. Free at last. And those things, those steps are the surgery of AA to me. My belief is, I'll only say this about them, I believe that I will never be a free man. I don't care how long I stay sober. I will never be a free man until I dig out and make right all those wrongs that I visited on the world around me. Every time I took advantage of somebody, I didn't win, I lost. And I paid for it with a piece of my soul. And I don't care how many people pat me on the head and tell me what a wonderful fellow I am. If I'm dragging that stuff, I guarantee you I'm dragging an anchor that's going to hold me in mediocrity for a long, long time. And interfere with the new life. And, well, those things happened to me in a maximum custody penitentiary. Every bit of it. Well, I was talking with my good friend this morning, yesterday about, some people say this, you ought not to look at that as sobriety, that you ought to count your sobriety when you walk out there. Good God. That would be the biggest insult to the miracle of my life that I could possibly imagine. My God, every gift that Alcoholics Anonymous gives was given to me in a maximum custody penitentiary. I've never been more richly rewarded anywhere because I became a free man in every sense of the word except physically. Every sense of the word. Developed the first worth I ever had in my life in a maximum custody penitentiary. Learned to live with some dignity and honor in a maximum custody penitentiary. Learn to be of useful service to my fellow man, just like the book says. The book says, it's sure we're working on ourselves, but if that's what we're spending our time doing, we're sure giving ourselves a real short sale. Because it says our real purpose is to fit ourselves to be of maximum service to God and those around us. And man, if you can't find that among 6,000 convicts, you ain't looking much. So I had a marvelous time. As much as I hated that place, I had a marvelous time in learning how to be of service in Alcoholics Anonymous. I tell you, it's a silly sounding thing, but as much as I hated play, and I don't think there's ever been a man in a penitentiary hated it worse than I did. But when I was getting ready to leave, and he was leaving the next day, I found, I'm walking out, I found myself thinking, gee whiz, I need a couple more days just to finish up some of my AA stuff. Is that some that you go, well, I didn't tell anybody that. I ain't no way, man. I am leaving at the stroke of whatever's running. I'm getting out of here. And so when I hit the street, I was, transition's easy if you're well prepared. It is a bear if you're not. Yeah. I see somebody mentioned something, and it is very, very true. I think Harold mentioned it. It's very true to my whole belief system. The only people that I have ever seen make it coming out of corrections are the ones who are making it while they're in corrections. Those salvation at the gate things are nice theory. It just doesn't happen. And unless somebody's well prepared. I'll just tell you just one example of that, because I know that you guys agonize over this too. One of the things that was a good learning thing for me, I was a barber when I was in there. I finally got into barbering. And in all honesty, I wasn't much of a barber. But there was not a lot of competition, so I had a lot of I cut a guy's ear off one time. Not all of it. I mean, I just cut a little piece of it. But I mean, you'd have thought I cut his neck off the way he got so mad. If he tried to put it back on, he wouldn't sit still long enough to put it. Well, I think he'd have gone at me, but I'm the only guy standing around there with a razor, so he wasn't about to make any quick moves. But he sure talked to me ugly. Anyway, I was a persistent barber, and I was giving people their going home haircuts. Well, I mean, you won't treat a guy right when he's going home, you know, and he'd go out and see folks. So I'd really take my time on you. And when I'd get somebody in the chair that had been in the program, I mean, I talk program stuff. It's just natural. Where are you going, man? Going to Detroit. What are you going to do, man? I'm going to live down there, and I'm going to work it for it, you know. And I said, where are you going to meetings? And I swear to God, I'll never understand it. That's one of the questions I still have. How many times guys that had looked to me like they were solid in the program would pull back and look at me and say, man, you're really serious about this thing. Now, you better believe I'm serious about this thing, and I hope you are. But how many people that is some kind of an institutional performance has no relationship to real life? I have never understood that, never wanted to understand it. I made a career of corrections, but I still don't understand that. And unfortunately, I had the experience of giving many of them their welcome back haircuts, too. And I guarantee you, I listened to them, because when I get one to chair that had been out there and come back, I'm cold-blooded. I learn as much from losers as I do winners. And so I get a guy in here, I say, tell me what happened. Tell me what you did. I want to hear it in detail. What did you do? And I listened to that, and I learned from that. So when my time came, I was hooked up a year before I was even eligible for release and knew exactly what I was going to do. When I hit the ground, it was just a matter of implementing. I didn't have to figure out what to do. It was already done. And just had to put it in motion. Went to a meeting the first night and most nights thereafter for a long time. I was the prisoner freed. I was a man, just like anybody leaving prison. I had small dreams. It wasn't anything big, just small dreams. I just wanted to find work. I wanted to make an honest living for a change. I wanted to be trusted. I wondered if I would ever be trusted by anybody. That if I have a friend, I was not sure. And those are real kinds of concerns that I had. And wanted to be a citizen. I had never been a citizen in my life. I was the kind of guy that put Flint on the worst city list. You know, that's what I did. I never added the property values. I put them down by just being there. I mean, just living there would bring them down. And so I wanted to be a citizen. I never had paid taxes. I never had filed a return. I wanted to do some of that stuff. Little dreams. Yeah. And they come true. I want to tell you just a few things, and I'll quit. I won't be through, but I'll just quit. I've developed a technique about how long to talk. I know some of you do some talking. If you've done talking, you can tell when you're done. I mean, nobody has to say anything. But you'd be looking at the crowd, and they'll look lively and interested, and then all at once, it's like a film drops over the eye. And they just sort of sit there in a coma, you know. You keep on talking all you want to, but you're done. I mean, you're done. And so I've developed it. One skill I've developed is I can anticipate that by about 2 minutes. So when I start to say, man, I'm out of here. But I want to just tell you some things that happened to me that are just absolutely unbelievable things in my way of looking at stuff. I'm a great believer in miracles, but I'm a pretty pragmatic type of guy. I'm a very practical guy. I'm a deeply spiritual man, but I'm not a magical thinker type of guy. My definition of miracles is it's what happens when preparation meets opportunity and God does the introduction. When preparation meets opportunity and God does the introduction, things happen beyond my wildest dream. When I hit the street, 2 weeks after I was out, I got active immediately. And 2 weeks after I was out, some guys asked me to go over to prison. I said, man, they're not going to let me in one of those places. Just got out of one. They're not going to let me back in one. And may not let me out. Yeah, so I wasn't sure I wanted to go. Hey, right, come on. So I went. 2 months after I was out, I was named outside sponsor of that prison. I just got out of one. Now, you talk about affirmation, brother. That is affirmation. I could not have been more happy if I'd have been elected governor. It was an absolutely unbelievable honor. About the same time, a pro guy came to me one day, and he said, Tom, you're real active in this A thing, and it concerned me because I thought he was going to tell me to slow down, and knew I wouldn't. And he said, wouldn't it help if you could drive? And I said, yes, sir, but I can't, like he didn't know. And he said, let me check it out. A little later, he asked me to meet him at the Sears store uptown. It really does sound like Mayberry, but that's where the license agency was. My sister drove me up, walked in. My guy was standing back there with a fellow I didn't know who was a license agent, and we visited. I don't know about what, hunting dogs or whatever they were talking about. They were talking. I'm just standing there listening to them. And so we got through with the visit, and the guy I didn't know turned to me and handed me a driver's license. It didn't even ask me if I could drive. I mean, nothing. No test whatsoever, road, written, verbal, nothing, absolutely nothing. Didn't even pay for it. Can't be legal. But I've been driving ever since. So it must be. Always with a license. Yeah. Now, I tell you what I honestly believe. And not just on the strength of my own case, but God knows how many hundreds of unbelievable cases that I've encountered. When God's got work for us to do, the walls come down. I don't care what they are. They come down. And that's what that was. If I had been trying to manipulate that into happening, I swear to God, I believe I'd be walking today. Elected DCM 5 months after I was out. Same guy who wondered if he'd ever be trusted. And I was a trusted servant for 15 cities in my state. Yeah. 2 years after I was out, I was sitting in my house one day, got a phone call from the state capitol. A guy on the phone introduced himself. I'd met him once. He was a staff member in the prison system. And he'd come to the meeting that I sponsored one time and just stopped by. He was just making a site visit to that unit. And we chatted for a few minutes, the only time I ever saw him in my life. And it was him, and he made me remember who he was. And then he said, Mr. Ivester, we're expanding the rehabilitation program in our prison system, and we were wondering if you would consider accepting a position. Well, the day of that phone call, there had never been an ex-con in history hired anything like that. I knew that. And I sure knew they weren't going to start with me. And the first thing I said was, do you know who you're talking to? And he assured me he did, that they probably knew me better than I knew myself. Yeah, of course they'd check me out. And I said to him what I really meant up here. I said, God, I'd rather do that than anything I could imagine. And inside I said, there ain't no way. When God's got work for us to do, the walls come down. Clue knows. So I was employed in November 61 as a rehabilitation officer in the prison system in North Carolina. I had no real formal training. I'd finished 2 years at Michigan State by television while I was in there, but that had nothing to do with corrections. All it was just a 2-year degree. And so I started to work. I mean, I loved it. I didn't even know whether they paid or not. I never did ask anybody. I'd have done it for nothing. And probably shoplifted on the side or something. I don't know what I would have done. Old behavior, sometimes helpful. And I just went to work and loved it. Good God, I was 9 years before I took a vacation. Where would I go? I was in hog heaven. My God, I'm right in the middle of the action. And the strange thing happens when you do good work. God is ever a hunger for leadership, eh, Jim? A hunger for leadership. A hunger for competency. A hunger for loyalty to a job. And all you got to do is do good work. I tell you this, I rarely say this because it almost sounds like some magic show. From the day I started in Alcoholics Anonymous, I have never applied for one single job, promotion, transfer, nothing. What I've done is given my level best to every job I've ever had. And it's amazing how people are looking for folks who do that. And so I started getting pulled into supervision and then into management and then started to direct some programs. And then I co-managed a facility. And then one day the head of our system. Now, it's remarkable enough to be working in a system. And one day the head of our system, the director of the Department of Prison System, asked me to swing by his office that he had something he wanted me to do, and that normally meant pinch hit for me somewhere, making a speech or something. So I went by and said, okay, boss, what? And we chatted just for a minute, and he said, Tom, I would like for you to take over an institution as warden. And I don't care how goofy you might be. That is one thing that you never think of when you're sitting in a joint. You know, one of these days, I'm going to get out here and run one of these dudes. I'll show them how to do it. But when I got up off the floor, I said, boss, come on, man. I don't want to be the head screw. I don't want to be the guy with the Uzi standing around out. And I said, what do you got in mind? And as he told me. And he knew me. He knew me pretty well. And it had enough newness and creativity to it that it had appeal. And so I listened to him and I said, will you give me some time to think about it? And he said, of course. Take 5 minutes. Took 5 minutes, prayed hard, went back in, did it. And that started about the next 20 years of my career. And it was a marvelous, marvelous experience. I had the opportunity to do some bold, new, creative things that had never been done in my state that I feel very, very grateful to have participated in. Opened some doors in corrections that had never been opened, and I'm deeply, deeply grateful for that. And so I put in 39 years, and the overwhelming majority of it was as warden and correctional administrator with either running facilities or statewide management type of stuff. So it was a wonderful, wonderful career, and I wouldn't have traded it for anything. I didn't think I was ever going to quit. And then I learned I was the oldest guy in there, and I never aspired to be that. And I also learned I'd make about as much money retired as I did working. So I said, shoot, this is crazy. So I finally gave it up. And when I left, I pretty well closed the door. I closed the door. When I leave, I close the door. I don't live with one foot yesterday and another one out yonder somewhere. I try to stay right where I'm at. And so when I left, I had already been contacted. AA Grapevine is super. The word got around that the old man was going to hang it up. And I had already been elected to be the area corrections chair upon retirement. So my retirement lasted about one nanosecond, you know. That. And all I did was quit getting paid and then just moved to the other side of the fence is all I did. And we really have had a wonderful time with that. I'll just tell you this. If you know, obviously after, I mean, I'm a high pressure type of guy. I'm not somebody who lollygags around. I'm either charge or dead stop. There is no cruise control. And so I just finished a 39 year career that was just consuming. And I thought about some fantasies like just taking long walks and playing golf and stuff like that. And then I thought, when those guys asked me about being the area chair for corrections, that what went through my mind was, you know, my God, man, you've been in this a lifetime. If there's anybody on this planet that understands the plight of an alcoholic in prison, it's you. And if there's anybody in this state that has greater access to getting into the system and influencing things, I don't know who it'd be. And my earnest belief was that when I can look at an area of need like that and know that I have the capability to try to contribute to it, if I walk away, I'll guarantee you I'm a lesser man for it. And so I stepped into it and had a marvelous, marvelous time. We've done some, I alluded to some of that yesterday, we've done some excellent stuff in North Carolina. We have absolutely developed a working relationship with our prison system that's second to nothing on this planet. Nothing on this planet. And in the course of doing it, you know, as I mentioned yesterday, we've worked with every manager, every director, every warden in the state, every one of them. I tell you one other thing that happened that was unbelievable, and it was not just owing to my history. That helped a little, but it was not just owing to that. At one point, we started to put our strategies in place to more aggressively develop AA in the state, get it sort of coordinated. We saw that our own policies, the corrections policies, had us in jail as much as they did the inmates. We simply could not generate the flexibility necessary to deal with remote facilities. We couldn't have the flexibility. We were married into this sort of one-dimensional approach to stuff. And so I had told the director when we met that we wouldn't bother him again unless we saw some major problems, and that was a major problem. So we went back. I told him, I said, man, we got some problems. We're in jail with the policy. And so we talked about that and what the problems were. He asked some staff to look at it. And now this is the thing that's unbelievable. And Jim could tell you about it. I mean, he was in this stuff longer than I was. This guy had the vision and the imagination and the backbone to ask a group of citizens to sit down with the thinkers of the prison system and draft a policy that would be user-friendly to Alcoholics Anonymous and was specific to Alcoholics Anonymous. So we did. And we have a policy. I've got one in my room. I'd be glad to share. I think Julia probably has a copy. We have a policy that there is nothing on this earth like. And it is absolutely astounding to me that happened. My greatest fear, is it ever a friend? But my greatest fear is how responsibly we will respond to that openness that has been generated. We are truly, it's like you were saying, we're truly like herding cats sometimes. And many, many times in our zeal to do stuff, we're not mindful enough of being responsible and taking advantage of the opportunities that are there. And that's my greatest concern, is that we will responsibly and effectively deal with that. I just close up. I mean, it's been a magnificent life so far, and I'm just getting started. I'll close up on one thing that I know that probably this is service folk. You are my kind of folk. And I could visit with y'all for a week, and then you'd be enemies. But what I want to share with you is this, that I know that anybody that has a strong, active service life has conflicts about whether it's really being fair to those who are emotionally attached to you. Family, children, employers, community. There's always fears about that. And you can just take my word for it. I'm as busy as any man I know and have been for as long as any man I know. And what I'd like you to know is this. There is absolutely nothing of any importance in my life, nothing that has not been richly enhanced by the life that has come. None. I'm married to the same gal for 36 years last July. Amazing thing to me, I got. Amazing. Yeah. Finished a career with an unblemished record with a ragtag guy like me and went to the top of my profession. In my community, mayor calls me and asked me to vote for him. He wouldn't have spoke to me a while back. I tell you one thing, a sidebar to that was the people in the legal profession had a convention in my town, same place where we meet. And they asked me to do the speech at the deal, so I went over to do it. I had dinner sitting with the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court and two other justices and some other guys. So we're having that, and I got up to speak and told them that what an honor it was to be there. And I said, it's great to have dinner with the Chief Justice. A few years back, if I'd have had dinner with the Chief Justice, it would have been for my last meal. And then explained why, and they caught on. Yeah, but it's just amazing what happens to be able to function as a citizen. And I treasure that. Raised two kids that I don't think they inherited any major league intellect from me or their mother, but they've done well. They've done well. They grew up in a home where recovery was in place every day of their lives. And they've never had to live in an environment where there was anger and frustration and violence and profanity and this stuff. They grew up in a decent environment where there was nurturing and support. And I think that is very, very contributory to some good outcomes. Not everybody has that experience, but boy, we sure did. My kids went through the airhead phase like most kids do. And I tried to get them to join the Army or something, just anything to get away from home. Go, run away, or do something. And they wouldn't leave. And they both, for some reason, I don't know, graduated from the university system. My daughter went bad. She went into psychology. And now she manages developmentally disabled population in several counties of our state and has 76 case managers that she does that work with. Enormously proud of that girl. My son really looked like a great potential AA member. I really had hope for that boy. I mean, he was a contender, I believe, and went off to college, majored in fraternity in the first year. Did a good job. He was elected King Reggae on a class trip to Jamaica. And when that news got home, my wife said, "Isn't that awful?" I said, "Oh, yeah, geez, that's just terrible, terrible." And inside I'm saying, "Yeah, that's my boy. I knew that boy made out of good stuff." And then that turkey detoured, and the second year he got serious. And in 3 years, got his grades up adequately to get it accepted into medical school and finished up as a physician in the only specialty I told him to avoid like the plague, OBGYN. As if that weren't bad enough, he went back for a fellowship and developed a specialty in high-risk maternal fetal medicine. Holy mackerel. The other day, that meathead was telling me about... He's telling me about performing surgery on a fetus in a womb. And I'm thinking all the time, you airhead. There's no way. But isn't that amazing? Isn't that absolutely amazing? That boy's getting married the 6th of November. And to another doc. I'm not sure that's going to be a happy marriage. But the point is, that in every area of my life, it's been richly enhanced. The key to me is this. If AA does not compete with anything in my life, it competes with nothing in my life. Sometimes we say to people, AA has to come first, and that's just not right. That's not right, in my judgment. When I say that to somebody, that's a value assessment that this is more important than you. That's a different thing than saying my recovery has to come first. That's a whole different deal. And so AA doesn't compete with anything in my life. If it does, I'm not doing it right. Because every piece of my life has principles that govern it. My marriage, my career, my profession, everything has principles. And if my principles in AA are violating those, something's out of whack. So those principles will keep me in good shape, as long as I do them that way and not try to figure out how to manage it, micromanage my life. So it's been a heck of a deal. I do believe that I'm the most fortunate man that I know. Thanks.